From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2016, when a 34-year-old woman named Amy Lamb went into labor. She lived with her husband and her young child in New York City. This was going to be their second child, but the labor, the delivery, and especially the aftermath went wildly wrong. At first, she thought she was in labor. She was told she wasn't far enough along, but then, still at home, the labor progressed rapidly. She would deliver her second child at home with her husband alongside, and hours after giving birth, Amy was treated at Harlem Hospital. We should warn you that this conversation will explore medical injury, death, and grief. Amy died, and her loved ones raised questions about the decisions made by doctors. Well, one doctor in particular, Dr. Thomas Byrne, a man who had practiced medicine in New York State years earlier and was practicing again. The New York Health Department had investigated Byrne while he was practicing in upstate New York in the 1990s. The state found 5 cases over the span of just a couple of years in which Byrne's care as an OBGYN had caused or contributed to bad outcomes. 3 babies died. 2 were severely injured. And so the state labeled Byrne an imminent danger to the public and revoked his medical license. So where did Thomas Byrne go? Well, turns out he was able to go to several other states. He kept practicing medicine there. And then, years later, he somehow got his medical license reinstated in New York State. And he was in charge of Amy Lamb's care on the night she died. A podcast series from our colleagues at WNYC examines not only the story of Dr. Thomas Byrne, but how doctors are licensed and vetted. The investigative series is called Imminent Danger: One Doctor and a Trail of Injured Women. The reporter for the podcast is former WXXI reporter and producer Karen Chakurji, who is one of my guests this hour. Karen, welcome back to the program. Great to have you back on WXXI.
Thank you so much, Evan.
And welcome as well to Jacqueline Jeffrey Walensky, an investigative data reporter for WNYC and Gothamist. Jacqueline, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Susan Carton is also on the line with us, an attorney who has, you're going to hear, represented the family in the Amy Lamb case. Susan, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Karen Chakurji, in a moment, we're going to listen just to the first few minutes of this series. We've got a couple of clips this hour, and it's important to me, I'm sure it's important to you, that the story of Amy, that Amy is centered as a person. I mean, this is a tragic story. But before we even hear that, can you just describe how this came on your radar at all?
Yeah, absolutely. This was something that I came across several years ago while reading through line by line a lot of information that is available publicly in a data set that New York State keeps of every public disciplinary action taken against a physician since 1990. And in this spreadsheet, there is information about a physician, this OBGYN, who had his license revoked in 1991 and then had it reinstated in 2014. And so a lot of questions were raised right off the bat. You know, how did he get his license back? Why did he get his license back, considering the charges of negligence, fraud, and other related charges?
And those 1980s and 1990s days, Dr. Byrne, were right here in the Rochester Finger Lakes area in some ways, yes?
Absolutely. There's this document, it's 105 pages, and it goes through in great detail of the cases that took place at Newark Wayne Community Hospital and Geneva General back in the late 80s and early 90s, and the series gets into that quite a bit.
Let's listen to the opening minutes of Imminent Danger. You're going to hear Karen Chakurji telling the story of Amy Lamb. Let's listen.
I need to start this whole thing with telling you about a woman I've never met and what I've learned about her life before it took a tragic turn. This woman's name was Wai Chi Lam, but she went by Amy. She lived in Harlem. She was from Hong Kong. And she was a journalist. She moved to New York specifically to study journalism at Columbia University. I have a bunch of videos that her husband shared with me. Just a collection of everyday moments of her and her family. They're lovely, but also, ever since I first watched them, in many ways, they've haunted me. They're singing songs. Walking around the park on a nice sunny day. Doing bath time.
Wow.
There's just a lot of laughter and joy in the most simple and beautiful of ways.
Karen, I appreciate what you did there in telling that story. And it made it right off the jump of this series. It made it clear that this is, we're going to be hearing about data. We're going to be talking, we'll talk to Jacqueline, we'll talk to Bob Oshel later this hour about how we contextualize some of the data. But these are real human stories. And as hard as it is, and I want to keep warning listeners, we're going to be talking about some tough themes. Can you then describe how things went wrong for the birth of her second child and what happened? Karen, let me just jump in for one second. And Karen's reception sort of in and out there. So what we'll do is we'll see if we can just kind of reestablish a little bit better connection there. And as we do that, I want to ask Jacqueline Jeffrey Walensky, who's an investigative data reporter for WNYC and Gothamist. I'm grateful that you're here, Jacqueline, because, I'm, as a journalist, I kind of bring a journalistic eye when I listen to podcasts. As a listener, I'm trying to ask myself, what do I take from this? And I found myself, really moved by this series, not just for the personal stories we're going to hear, but because I found myself thinking, what do I need to know about doctors that I am in the care of? Ultimately, I think Karen and the team established that the story of Dr. Byrne is not the story of every doctor, not at all. But there are still valid questions about vetting, about sort of licensing, reinstatement, et cetera. And we'll talk about that later this hour. What stands out to you in terms of the data for how we can make sure that we as listeners are listening in a way that is not going to alarm, but better inform us in a series like this?
Yeah, that's a great thing to think about, because the stakes are incredibly high, as we heard in Amy's story. But thankfully, as we saw in the data, and as Karen and the others sort of established through their reporting, it's very, very, very uncommon. And for me, I think the real takeaway is less the frequency of doctors whose wrongdoing is as egregious as Dr. Byrne's, and more about loopholes in the system that made it possible for those to happen. So at both the federal and the state level, we found very few instances of doctors who hopped states like Dr. Byrne and who got their licenses back after losing them.
Well, I mean, that's a relief, I guess, of sorts. I think we've got Karen back. So if you want to tell the story of what happened to Amy on that night that she's giving birth to her second child, go ahead, Karen.
So essentially she ended up at Harlem Hospital, and there were really just a cascade of issues and procedures that happened. Several doctors were involved in her care. Sue, I know you're on the line. If you want to jump in at all, please do. But essentially, there was waiting that happened that I think was a key factor, that things maybe didn't happen as quickly as they should have, to address why she was losing as much blood as she was. Does that sound right to you, Sue?
Well, I just want to say that she gave birth in her home, because the first hospital, Beth Israel, had sent her home. She thought she was in labor, but they said no. So she went home, and she, a few hours later, went into labor. And the fire department came, and the baby was delivered, and Amy was fine. And the only issue that brought her to Harlem Hospital, I think it's important to establish, was this her placenta did not dislodge and come out. So the fire department wanted her to go to the hospital so that they could remove the placenta, because that can be very dangerous for the mother. So on the way to the hospital, Amy even took a picture of herself in the ambulance, smiling and happy, and everything seemed to be okay. Now she gets to the hospital, and that's where everything starts. And she had no choice. This is the hospital that the fire department took her to, although she was supposed to give birth down at Beth Israel. So you can continue, Karen.
Yeah, essentially that's she ended up there. She ended up getting a bunch of procedures done after they noticed that she was bleeding and trying to figure out where she was bleeding, where the bleeding was coming from.
All right, so let me just jump back in, Karen, because we lost that connection a little bit. So, Sue,
Me to tell a bit? I'll continue.
Yeah, if you can pick up the thread here, because I mean, I want to reestablish for listeners that this story is central to the series here, and obviously Susan Carton, right, attorney, is with us here, but it ends up, her care ends up in the hands of someone, of course, she didn't know Dr. Thomas Burns' history,
exactly,
the fact that he had a medical license revoked in 1991, but go ahead, take us through that.
Well, his license had, she didn't know that, but just for the record, his license had been given back to him 18 months before this occurred. And certainly, as part of this series, I hope that there is a rigorous questioning of how that happened, because we couldn't find out, and nor could Amy's family, except now we have a complaint before the OPMC, the Office of Professional Misconduct, and perhaps that will come front and center. But in any event, she entered the emergency room. She was fine. And she came under the care of a doctor by the name of Dr. Clark, who then attempted to do certain procedures on her to dislodge the placenta. But right after he did these procedures, he claims that nothing really happened, nothing moved. She started bleeding, and she started having very severe blood pressure issues. And now he rushed her up to the labor and delivery room, and that's where she came in contact with Thomas Byrne. And a lot of this, Dr. Byrne was not really claimed. He wasn't familiar with, you know, certain procedures and certain procedures and when a woman is bleeding after delivery. But he had a diagnosis, not a differential diagnosis, but a diagnosis of maternal hemorrhage. And this was early on, around 2 o'clock. Over the next few hours, he completely mishandled the case. She was continuing to bleed. They were giving her transfusions. Who knows where this blood was going, but it was just, she rocketed downward. And her blood pressure was down. And there were tests being taken during this time that showed all this. But nobody was reacting to it, and Byrne wasn't reacting to it. So now at some point, like around 6 o'clock, they decided to do some procedure. What they should have been doing is an exploratory laparotomy to go in to see what was causing the bleeding. But they didn't do that, and they ended up doing a hysterectomy, and she was getting worse and worse, and about 8:30, she died. Now, what is so egregious about this case is the fact that Amy could have been saved had the diagnosis been made earlier of that she was bleeding, that she was bleeding out, and what was causing this. This is not something that's so esoteric that doctors can't find the cause of internal bleeding. There was never another diagnosis entertained, and nothing was acted upon until very late after 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock. And she died on the operating table at 10:30. And there were other doctors involved in this as well. But Dr. Byrne was somebody who was targeted by me in this lawsuit, among several other doctors. And when I came to do his deposition, this is when I found out the egregious history that he had prior to seeing Amy. Up until then, we knew nothing.
One of the frustrating parts for listeners of this series, and Karen makes clear how hard they tried to get a response from Dr. Byrne, who was, you know, still practicing now, and no response. Different team members ended up trying to meet him in person just to kind of talk, and couldn't get anything to kind of get on the record about not only the Amy Lamb case, but his history, his reinstatement, et cetera, et cetera. Do you have any sense for his justification of this? And can you characterize at all what we know about Dr. Byrne's approach to this, Susan?
Well, you know, none of this would have come out if we hadn't done the deposition of Dr. Byrne. Mm-hmm. And I asked one of the, you know, leading questions you always ask: are you licensed to practice in the state of New York? Yes. And have you been so licensed from what time to what time? And that's where it started, where he said, oh, I was not practicing during this time. And why weren't you practicing? Because my license had been revoked. Oh, and then we went back. And we found out this wasn't just a one-off situation. This guy had problems everywhere he went, New Mexico, Oklahoma. There were some other places, too. There were lawsuits that trailed him. It was a mess, a complete mess. And yet he was first of all, the big question is, how did he get his license back in 19? I believe it was 2000 or 9. I'm not sure of the exact date, but he had to come to New York, and
it was 2014.
He had to reapply and go through a procedure, which, I mean, anybody looking at this and looking at his record, you don't have to be a genius doctor to see that this man, as they said, was an imminent danger to patients. And this was borne out by his record.
Well, I want to listen to another clip from the podcast series, Imminent Danger. We're talking about that with the reporter, Karen Chikurji, who is a reporter on Imminent Danger, One Doctor and a Trail of Injured Women, which is a series that is out now in full. You're hearing from Susan Carton, who is an attorney. Jacqueline Jeffrey Walensky is with us, investigative data reporter for WNYC and Gothamist. And in this clip from the series, you're going to hear Lyle Kelsey, executive director of the Oklahoma State Medical Board. He started just before Dr. Byrne got a license there. And I don't know if I was ready for this soundbite. Karen talking to Lyle Kelsey about how do you vet everybody who's applying for a medical license, and can you do it? And so let's listen to this exchange.
How does the board make sure that what the physician is submitting is accurate?
Well, you don't know. Do we hope that the doctors do the right thing? Absolutely. But we also know that they're just like the general population, too. I mean, they can tell lies and be dishonest as well. We license almost 30,000 licensees in 14 different professions. And somewhere you have to hope that they're all being honest when they renew their license and answer questions.
Do you think that hope is enough when it comes to a profession of people who are taking care of patients? Does that work out okay?
Well, I'm not so sure what your question is. Of course, you recognize that it's a learned profession, highly educated people, and you would presume by that that these people would be honest and forthright in answering questions. And occasionally we may find out that somebody has lied on their application, and that becomes then a fraudulent application. But I don't think there's anything wrong with hope.
Woo. Karen, if we've got you back here, Did that hit you in the moment the way it hit me as a listener? Like, I can't believe I'm hearing this?
I was a little taken aback by the response. I wasn't especially surprised because I have heard from several people that I've spoken to that medical boards are quite understaffed and under-resourced in terms of being able to pursue the investigations that they want to pursue. I have also heard that they don't do as much as they can do as far as looking into physicians for a number of complex reasons. But it was noteworthy for sure.
So, Susan Carton, before we let you go here in just a couple of minutes, that soundbite is tough to hear because as a listener, Karen's reporting had already informed us that, you know, Dr. Byrne had the history that he had in New York State, that he would later, after getting his license reinstated, be involved in this case with Amy Lamb. Can you describe for listeners the outcome of that case before you go, and what you make of this what you make of this idea that vetting is hard, and you know that they can't go over line by line of every possible physician's claims here. What do you think?
My reaction to that portion of his statement that we have to trust all doctors and hope is the way we do this is it's just beyond. This is probably one of the most important aspects of somebody's life when they're seeing a doctor, particularly when they're giving birth to a child, and so much trust is put into that relationship that it is unfathomable that there isn't a really working way that they go about vetting people. I don't care how long it takes, or if you have somebody with a history and they're not disclosing it all, there are ways of finding things out. And to me, they don't want to know. They just don't want to know. It's like pushing these doctors along, particularly ones that want to come back to New York and have been out of the system for a while. They should be put under a greater scrutiny. Where have they been? What have they been doing? Have they been sued? Are there lawsuits pending against them? This is not something to be trusted on hope. And it's only because it really, until your series came up, and Karen worked with me, she's amazing. I'm so glad that you have all done this, because it's really not conducive to the public knowing about this. They don't know to check doctors. They don't ask questions about doctors. People still, even when I pick juries, they're reluctant to hold doctors accountable. It's changed somewhat, but they've been held up to such high esteem that a lot of people don't even think that something like this can happen. And then you have the state, who has the responsibility to see that these doctors are properly credentialed and haven't had these kinds of issues, particularly when New York labeled him as a menace, in essence, to people's care. There has to be even a more rigorous going over his and others. And I understand that it's not every doctor that's like this, but one can do such damage. This family was so damaged by Amy's death. Her husband has cared for these two children. Her older son, who was 5 at the time that this happened, every day he asked his father to take him out to the park to look for mommy. It was tragic, and I handle a lot of tragic cases, but this was one of the most that I ever had, because it was so devastating. He went home from the hospital. She was happy when she went into the hospital, and the whole family got really messed up behind this. After the depositions the case was settled by the city of New York, because the city owns is in charge of Harlem Hospital, and those monies are being used by Gilbert, the father, to raise these children. But it's been one child has been in therapy since this happened, and it's taken a big toll on him, the father, as well. I mean, he is just devastated by the loss. Amy was supposed to go back to China before the birth of the child, but they wanted their child to be born in America and have the care that we, you know, have come to know that most hospitals provide. So, you know, it is something that beyond just what happened to them in the medical care, how this was allowed to happen. I hope that we get some answers from the Office of Professional Misconduct. I have filed an extensive report on my findings, and I'm hoping that they respond. The only response I've gotten is that, you know, it's being looked at. It may take years for us to complete this investigation. Something is wrong with the system.
Sue, thank you for making time for the program today.
No problem. It's my honor to be part of this. Thank you.
Susan Carton is an attorney, and so let me turn to Jacqueline and Karen, and then we'll take a brief break, and we're going to cover a lot of ground in our second half hour as we examine the impact of this podcast series that Karen Chikurji reported for WNYC and Gothamist, Imminent Danger, One Doctor and a Trail of Injured Women. The podcast series is live. You can listen to the whole series wherever you find your podcasts. You know, Jacqueline, when Sue says, I understand it's not all doctors that are like this, but one doctor can do enormous damage. There is not, as I think as you mentioned earlier, let's stress this point. The point of this series is not to convince people that, well, your doctor and you are next. It is to say that the system doesn't vet very well, but we don't have evidence that it is run amok with Dr. Thomas Burns, right?
Yes, exactly. That the stakes are very high when you're delivering care that's this intimate and this important, and it is a life or death matter, but that the data overwhelmingly shows us that doctors like Burns are extremely rare, extremely rare. We looked through records on millions of doctors over decades using a national database, you know, specifically designed to help track doctors like Burn who move from state to state to state, and found very few doctors in his position.
And Karen Chikurji, I always think it's interesting when you talk to reporters about, you know, an investigation this deep, this long, you know, what you hope comes out of it, because ultimately your job is to shine light on something, and the audience will take it how they, you know, how they do. The system may change for it. I mean, I wonder if you find yourself rooting is the wrong word, but kind of expecting systemic change, some kind of response about vetting and systems and how doctors are licensed or sort of reinstated. How do you feel about all that?
I think it would be great for there to be greater scrutiny, for there to be more scrutiny on physicians before they're given privileges at hospitals, before they're given their licenses from medical boards. I mean, I think for me, the story isn't even really about Dr. Burn exactly, from my perspective. It was looking at his track record was illuminating as far as the systems at play, both at a local level, at the hospital level, at the state level, as far as medical boards and national databases that are meant to, specifically one called the National Practitioner Data Bank, that is meant to prevent the very issue of physicians hopping from place to place. This is something that was established decades ago by Congress. It is meant to prevent the very issue of physicians being able to move between states and hospitals. And so for me, the takeaway is just to raise awareness, some awareness, that the systems are not always as effective as one might hope that they would be. And so that's what I, you know, kind of took away from it.
We've got some interesting feedback from listeners that we'll share in our second half hour. We have to take this only break of the hour, and we'll come back with Karen Chikurji, who is the reporter behind Imminent Danger, the podcast about one doctor and a trail of injured women. Jacqueline Jeffrey Walensky is with us, an investigative data reporter for WNYC and Gothamist. And in a moment, we'll be joined by Dr. Robert Oschel, who's a malpractice and medical disciplines issues expert at the Patient Safety Action Network. We're right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on the next Connections, the Rochester Jazz Festival is coming back. The International Jazz Festival back in full swing, and we'll talk about who's coming, who's performing, talk to the organizers, the producers, and some of the artists. In our second hour, Life in the CIA, exploring a book and talking to someone who spent years in the CIA. That's Tuesday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Imminent Danger, One Doctor and a Trail of Injured Women is a podcast series that is out now. It is, you might have heard it's featured on NPR. It is being recognized for the rigor of the work. And we're talking to the reporter, Karen Chakurji, who is formerly of WXXI. We're happy to claim Karen and our partnership with Karen there. But watching and listening to the work of Karen and the team that put this together, and we're talking about the impact, what it means to have a system in which, you know, vetting doctors can be difficult. It's not to say that every physician everywhere is not vetted. That's not at all the point. It is to say that when there are people who are misrepresenting themselves, as apparently Dr. Thomas Byrne has done for years, it can be, you know, the system may not be designed to catch it, to stop it. And I want to bring in Robert Oschel. Dr. Oschel is a malpractice and medical discipline issues expert at the Patient Safety Action Network. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, glad to be with you.
Tell me a little bit about the mission of the Patient Safety Action Network, Bob.
Well, the Patient Safety Action Network is a group of people interested in patient safety, basically. A lot of them people are those who were harmed by medical malpractice or whose family members were. And then there are a few of us who were involved professionally with medical licensing, medical discipline, medical malpractice attorneys, and people involved with organizations such as Public Citizen, all of which, you know, all of these folks are interested in trying to make the system better so that the physicians who do have a record of bad malpractice are identified and then are in a position to have something done about them by the licensing boards or the credentialers at hospitals and you know, other medical organizations.
Did any part of this series surprise you, Bob?
Not really, no. I mean, it's, you know, for 15 years I was with the National Practitioner Data Bank in charge of research and dispute resolution. And we get, or the data bank got, reports on all malpractice payments in the country, on licensure actions taken by the licensure boards, and by clinical privileges, or about clinical privileges actions taken by hospitals. And, you know, most of the reports would be about somebody who had a malpractice payment, and you wouldn't hear of that person again. But in doing analysis, we'd find that there were a lot of frequent flyers, if you will, as well, people who over and over again got into trouble with malpractice or with licensure actions. And a lot of them would move from one state to another or from one hospital to another. And if the information was used as it should be by the licensure boards or by the hospital credentialers, they wouldn't have been licensed or put on the staff again, but they were. And so it doesn't surprise me what Karen found at all.
Well, and so let me read for all of our guests, if they want to weigh in, an email from a listener signed from Dr. Susanna Markle, who says, "Evan, to present the other side of the story here, for practicing physicians, it is onerous to apply and maintain licensure and credentialing at institutions. There is a huge burden of documentation every time one applies for a license or credentials at a new facility. Why do we not have a more reliable system of keeping the bad apples out? It is not for the lack of burdening physicians. The whole system needs an overhaul." End quote. What do you make of that, Bob?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in what she says. The Federation of State Medical Boards does maintain a system where physicians can provide their application information once for state licensure, and then suggest, you know, and then direct that information be sent to another state. I'm not sure if hospitals can use that or not, but typically, you know, each state makes its own decisions. Each hospital makes its own decisions. The hospitals are required to query the National Practitioner Data Bank to confirm information. The states are not. And the managed care organizations actually use the data bank more than hospitals do in terms of querying for staff, in terms of, you know, applying for licensure. Applying for a position in the organization. So the information is there, and but it is a burden on physicians to keep things up to date. One of the things we found, by the way, when we did a study, oh, this is years ago at the data bank, we did a study asking users of data bank information if they learned anything new from a data bank report. If the system was working the way it was designed, they would never learn anything new from a data bank report because the application that the physicians file have to include everything that's reported to the data bank and more. But what we found was that 9% of the time, the respondents said we did learn something new from a data bank report, which means that physicians with bad records were not being truthful on their applications, or they had bad memories, you know, whatever. But organizations were learning things new from the data bank, and that should never happen if they had full information on applications.
Hmm. Karen, what did you think of the email that I just read?
I think that makes a lot of sense, that there needs to be a better way for doctors to supply the information that's required. I'm not surprised at all to hear that it might be time-consuming and painstaking, perhaps, in terms of the amount of paperwork and documents that need to be provided. But to me, that sounds like a maybe different issue than what Bob is talking about as far as, you know, proper disclosure, right? Those are kind of, maybe they're related, but they're two different things, right? Because somebody who might be, you know, pressed for time and feeling a little feeling frustrated perhaps with the amount of paperwork that does need to be submitted, that is not necessarily one and the same with a physician who is not disclosing, you know, a fair amount of information.
Well, and here's an email from Pat who says, I have an interesting story. It sounds to me like the physician in question is either going to sue everyone involved for slander, although I think libel would be what they would sue for here, or because the physician involved is not responding, my guess is, has probably done all of the things he is accused of. Either way, interesting. So that's from Pat. Okay, let me start with Jacqueline on a broad point here. As an investigative data reporter, when you are reporting a story that is really sensitive, that involves a lot of work and a lot of digging, and frankly, people's reputations, how vital is it to make sure that every piece of data, every piece of information you have is correct before you publish, Jacqueline?
Oh my gosh, it's absolutely essential. Yeah. I had stress dreams for, you know, weeks leading up to publication, you know, even after, just like, what if, you know, something went wrong and I redid the analysis again and again in different methods. I sent this long memo to Dr. Oshel explaining everything I did, and he also advised heavily on the analysis. So lots of repetition, lots of checking, extensive documentation. For this story, particularly for the analysis of the National Practitioner Data Bank data, that large federal database, I didn't do the analysis in like Excel or Google Sheets. I did it with programming, and that is great for handling larger data sets. But the other main advantage is that you have documentation of every single transformation you do to the data. So anyone could look at the script and know exactly what I did. And then one thing I'll also say is that the National Practitioner Data Bank itself has lots of restrictions on how you can and can't use the data because it is so sensitive. So the data that's available to us as reporters is anonymized. And in fact, to use that data, the public use data file, you have to agree to not try to use that data to identify any one particular physician. It has to be an aggregate. And then for the state data analysis, the way we managed that was by cross-referencing extensively with public records. So yeah, it's a delicate process for sure.
And when you go to publish, Jacqueline, when it's finally out there in the world, do you brace for an email, a phone call from the subject? Do you think we have to hear from them now?
I think there's always that fear, but particularly with data, sometimes, not in this case, but I've had it happen that sources have called me or government sources have called me, and we've sat together on Zoom where I walk them through the analysis step by step. And so having that accountability and that documentation is absolutely essential, because you can show them exactly how you reach that conclusion.
Yeah, and I will say to Pat, you know, I was obviously not involved with this project, but we all know Karen here at WXXI. You know, Jacqueline is talking about the process here. And on top of that, the whole team of people involved in this wanted to get a hold of Dr. Byrne. They made many attempts, Karen Chakurji, to get in touch. I mean, I wonder now if you still would like to talk to Dr. Byrne.
I just to confirm, we not only did, you know, calls, texts, emails, we sent, I mean, an extremely, extremely detailed list of questions, you know, called right of reply, which essentially is giving somebody a heads up about what we are going to include so there are no surprises. And so that's something that we took very seriously. We also had an incredible researcher and fact checker, Ethan Corey, who works with us, really, really incredibly detailed work that he did. Our editor, Christopher Wirth, also did an incredible job, you know, as far as keeping us on point throughout the making of this series. So this was something that we took extremely seriously and would have, you know, really welcomed a chance to hear Dr. Byrne's perspective. I think that it's something that I would have loved to have been able to include in the series. Absolutely.
Dr. Oshel, again, you said there wasn't a whole lot of surprise on what you were learning from the team that was gathering this information. But to you at this point, is that pertinent here? Or do you think that it's a podcast series about a bigger issue? It's not just about one doctor or one person.
Well, it's certainly not just one doctor or one person. This kind of situation is far from unique, and it's far from unique even within one state. Look at the doctor death situation, Dr. Dunch down in Texas, who ended up in prison after basically killing several people and maiming others. And he was moving from hospital to hospital in the Dallas area without the hospitals taking effective action or the state licensing board taking effective action. And, you know, they could have known, they should have known this guy's record. So, you know, Byrne is not unique, and it's a national issue.
Dom says, Evan, the lesson here is clear. Trust nobody. I think Dom is kidding, but no, I don't think that's the lesson, Karen Chakurji. How would you feel if that was the lesson people took out of this?
No. I think that what one takeaway might be is that it can be helpful, if anything, for peace of mind, to learn about the physicians that you're going and seeking care for yourself or your family members. You know, while it can be a little bit of a to-do to find the information you want to find, it can take a little bit of time. There are some helpful resources out there. One thing that comes to mind is the Federation of State Medical Boards. They have a database that's open to the public. You go to docinfo.org. And what is helpful, what I find helpful about that database is that it pulls information from it's supposed to pull information from all medical boards, so across state lines. So you're not needing to go and say, well, my doctor is in New York State. I'm going to go to I'm going to go find out information from the from New York State specifically. You're able to go to this website and learn, oh, does my doctor have a license in multiple other states? Oh, has there been disciplinary action against them in other states? This is just one piece of the picture, because you're not going to see stuff on lawsuits there, but you will learn, you'll get a bit of a map. And so that might be one takeaway from this. Hopefully it's not don't trust anybody ever. Yeah.
What do you think, Bob, about Pat saying don't trust anybody?
Yeah, I wouldn't go quite that far, but trust but verify is sort of where I would land, I think. I would also recommend the DocInfo site from the Federation. But again, remember, that's only information about licensure actions. So what you need to do is follow up if there's a licensure action or you find out a person is licensed in a particular state. Then also go to that state board's website. The states vary tremendously in how useful and helpful their websites are. Some of the state websites will tell you about malpractice payments and will tell you about the actions taken by hospitals for disciplinary reasons as well. Other states won't tell you that. And, of course, all that's in the National Practitioner Data Bank, but Congress, in its wisdom back in 1986, said that that wasn't going to be open to the public. I think it ought to be. It would be a good one-stop, fairly comprehensive place for people to check their doctors. But the only way that's going to happen is if there's an outcry to congressmen and senators saying you've got to open the data bank. And they also at the same time would need to close reporting loopholes because there are ways that physicians and malpractice attorneys or hospitals get around reporting some things to the data bank. So that needs to be improved. But right now, it's the best there is, and the patients can't see it. Mm.
Jacqueline, do you want to weigh in on this idea of trust no one?
I would just reiterate what the others have said, that certainly don't trust no one. Always keep in mind that, there's, I think, over 1 million practicing physicians in the U.S., and so the number who rise to the level of Dr. Byrne is vanishingly small, but at the same time, there are resources available to you. One pipeline I might recommend for someone in New York State looking up their doctor, maybe start with DocInfo, see what comes up there. And then on that spectrum, the doctor described of less helpful to more helpful, I would say New York State's is so-so, but you can go to the Professional Misconduct and Physician Discipline database on the Department of Health website and search the doctor by their name, by their license number, whatever information you have available. And you can get some interesting information, including in many cases, documents and reports about any disciplinary action issued against your doctor by the state.
Very good. And I think that was from Dom's email, if I got Dom and Pat mixed up. Thank you for the email. And let
Can
me just...
I weigh in on
oh,
that?
Go, yeah, go ahead, Bob. Yeah. Go ahead, Bob.
You know, she said that the numbers, like Dr. Burns, were vanishingly small. And it is very small. We did a study looking at malpractice payments over a 20-year period. And we found that 1.8% of physicians were responsible for half of all of the medical malpractice dollars paid out. And most of those folks had multiple payments, not just one, not just two, but multiple. So it is a small number. The scary thing in that was that only 10%, or I guess it was actually closer to 11% of those folks that were responsible for half of all the money paid out for medical malpractice had ever had any action at all reported about disciplinary action from a state licensure board. So here we've got the worst of the worst, mm-hmm. and the state boards were not taking action against them. And hospital clinical privileges actions against this worst of the worst group were even fewer. Only about 6% of them had ever had any reported action taken against their clinical privileges. So they're out there and they're practicing, and the states and the hospitals need to do a better job to either get them retrained or do something to keep them from continuing to harm patients.
Well, I mean, maybe that's
a very small group.
Maybe that's a good place to wrap here. I was going to ask Karen about this to conclude it, and before the program, producer Megan Mack and I were talking about, the series and, what you take away from it. And so I understand Dom's point, but I also think I don't walk away from this thinking, oh, my gosh, I can't trust the next doctor I'm with. I think, thank goodness, I feel comfortable with doctors I'm with. But the system right now isn't doing a very tidy job of catching the ones that shouldn't be with patients. And thank goodness there are journalists like Karen Chakurji who are going to do this work, who are going to shine light on this and then let either the systems change and evolve or patients at least be better informed. It doesn't make us all conspiracy theorists. It just makes us better informed, and I think the work is so valuable. Karen, I'll close with this. The final episode does have the culmination of, because I'm wondering for five episodes, how in the world did this guy get reinstated in New York? And I left that series feeling like, I bet you Karen's frustrated because I'm frustrated. I still don't feel like I get it. And it's still amazing to me that it happened. But again, maybe that will change down the line in the future when systems change, Karen.
Yeah, I've continued to ask the education department and the health department for information. I haven't gotten more information. As you can hear in the final episode, we do run into a bit of a wall in terms of getting more information. So it would be nice, certainly, for there to be more transparency.
Well, I want to congratulate you on an important series, and thank you for taking the time, Karen. Outstanding work here on Imminent Danger, One Doctor and a Trail of Injured Women, a podcast series that is available now. It's gotten, I think, a lot of plaudits and a lot of praise, well-deserved. And it's nice to talk to you, former WXXIer Karen Chakurji. Thank you for making time for today's program, Karen.
Thank you, Evan. So nice to speak with you again.
And Jacqueline Jeffrey Walensky, investigative data reporter for WNYC and Gothamist, thanks for your expertise and perspective, and congratulations on the work here, Jacqueline.
Thank you. It was an honor.
Our thanks to Susan Carton, who joined us earlier, and thanks to Dr. Bob Oshel, malpractice and medical discipline issues expert at the Patient Safety Action Network. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
And from the whole team at Connections, Evan, Rob, Megan, Gary, saying thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.